This Flight Safety Detectives episode will start with an update to the Air India investigation, including providing additional details about the cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder. We'll also discuss a recently released NTSB report about the 2024 door blowout event involving a 737 MAX over Portland.
NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
We have another fine day. It's just you and I again today. Greg is off somewhere. For today, we got a couple of things that we would like to accomplish. We need to update on Air India, and we want to talk about the door plug that popped out of the Alaskan Airlines flight and the NTSB's activity around that. So with that, we've gotten a lot of comments and requests to clarify the flight data recorder issues with this airplane. There's a lot of confusion amongst our listeners that about there being dual boxes. So let's back it up. On this particular airplane, one of the more modern installations of flight data recorders, there are two boxes on the airplane, two identical boxes on the airplane, one located in the tail, one located in the nose. Part of the reason why they've done that is to meet the new requirements for prolonged electrical power for these boxes. Many, many accidents that I worked, the box would lose its electrical power instantly. And it wasn't on the emergency bus. It wasn't. And so in the sequence, if it wasn't just an immediate crash, if it was an event that happened at altitude and the airplane took several minutes to come down, we lost all the data, what was going on, what was being said. So finally, after years of recommending it, they are finally moving to do something about it. Now, the two units, one in the front and one in the back, are dual units. And this is where the confusion has generated in a lot of people. Both what we know as the flight data recorder, historically, and the voice recorder are now located in one unit, one box, if you will. So the same data is recorded in the front of the airplane as recorded in the back of the airplane. So we have two chances of getting the data all the way to the end of the event. And that can be a blessing. They did recover, in the case of India, they did recover both boxes, and they've downloaded, but the one in the front was extensively damaged, and I understand that that one has come to the United States for the NTSB to take it apart and analyze what's on that. Now, I don't understand why they would do that when they have a good box from the back of the airplane. It's not clear. The Indians have not said anything about that. In fact, they haven't even said very much about the box coming to the U.S. So it's a lot of speculation on the part of us and others to what's going on with the box.
But and getting back to the update show we did about Air India, first, I'd like to thank our audience. We had more comments on that episode than any episode we've ever had on the Flight Safety Detectives. And, of course, several of you pointed out, rightfully so, that we were somewhat misleading talking about the cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder. We were unaware of specifically how the 787 was designed. In fact, just this afternoon, before we did the show, I learned a new acronym, Enhanced Airborne Flight Recorders, EAFR. It combines CVR and FDR, that is the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder. And as John explained, it's a whole different design to ensure that you get good data, even in a catastrophic situation. And the sequence of events in the Air India crash, the first impact was on a building, and that was where the tail section was torn off from the rest of the airplane. And it's unclear how much more or how much less data was in the rear device versus the front device, because as John mentioned, the Indian authorities who are leading this investigation haven't exactly been quite clear about what's going on. For example, they didn't mention the phrase EAFR in the one press release we saw from the Civil Aviation Ministry. They still refer to them as the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder. So we apologize for any confusion. We'll do better in the future.
You know, and there's another thing that's bothering me about the Indian authorities and what's been discussed, and that is the fact that nobody is talking about the first officer. He is just sort of ignored in here. And A, that's very unusual. And B, for me, as someone who used to be very in tune with the pilots and their skill levels, that I find that troubling. Nobody's talking about him or her. I don't even know who it is. Nobody's talking about that person. They just talk about how many hours he has. They don't talk about how many hours in type. He's just sort of invisible over there. And I have seen that in a couple of previous accidents where the first officer or a pilot is not a stellar employee. I was trying to find the right words. Not a stellar employee, and they want to just keep that quiet or out of the press as a lead story, maybe buried in the back of the story. And that's just my gut feeling. But I'm concerned about the fact that nobody is focusing on this guy. They focus on the captain all his time. I'm not so sure that things are not amiss in the middle of that somewhere.
And there are several things that we're concerned about with this investigation. As we stated in earlier shows, the fact that there didn't seem to be, how should I say it, care taken with the crash site, maintaining integrity of the debris for the investigators to look through them. Things seem to have been scooped up and cleaned up before there was really a thorough investigation on the ground. So there might be issues with the aircraft, there might be issues with the pilots, there might be issues with other things, but one of the key sets of information was lost in the sense of they lost the integrity of the scene. Now, going forward, we hope that that's not going to be the case with the data off the boxes. As we stated before, the Indian authorities did take those and they downloaded the data, at least for the first time, in India itself. And they had representatives from, according to a Ministry of Civil Aviation press release, the AAIB, and the press release was sort of unclear. There are two AAIBs. There's a Indian AAIB, and I believe the other one they implied was the British AAIB. The British are also part of this investigation, party to the investigation, rather. And also, there was an NTSB person or group at the downloading site in India. It's unclear what role they played. It's unclear whether or not they were able to do this without external help and expertise, or whether the Indian authorities did it all on their own. Apparently, from a press release I saw, it was only in the last few months that India had their lab fully set up to analyze this kind of data.
It's gone pretty quiet. There's been virtually no new facts being released. It's fallen off the front page, which is what the carriers always want to happen. It doesn't matter if it's India, no matter who it is. They would like to see it not on the front page. So we will keep our eyes and ears open and try to keep our viewers and listeners informed. But it's going to go slow, I think, at this point, unless there's some dramatic revelation. The other thing that we wanted to do today was just give you a look at the findings from the recent NTSB hearing into the Alaska Airlines door plug that vacated the airplane at altitude, and what the NTSB has found and shared with the world in their public hearing for their report.
And before we go into that, I'd like to give a very quick synopsis for those of you who are unfamiliar with this, or even very familiar with it. It seems like it happened only yesterday, but it was almost 18 months ago, on January 5th, 2024. There was a 737 MAX-9 taking off on a routine flight from Portland. And shortly after takeoff, the plug door blew out. The plug door is a exit door that's toward the back of the aircraft that's used as a regular emergency escape route for certain configurations of the aircraft. This was not a configuration that had so many seats that you needed an extra exit door. So instead of having a door there, they had what's called a plug door. Basically, it is an insert that's bolted in. It's never opened. In fact, if you were a passenger in the aircraft, you would just see a regular sidewall. There'd be no indication from the inside that there's a door on the other side of the wall. But there was. And this particular door, when it was manufactured, the door was installed on the assembly line. It was taken off from its mountings for whatever reason and then put back on before the fuselage was sent to Boeing. A little bit of history here. This was from the days when Spirit AeroSystems was a separate company from Boeing, and they manufactured the fuselages for the 737. They're shipped by rail over to Renton, Washington, and assembled. Spirit AeroSystems crews did the door plug removal and replacement. When it was at Boeing for the final assembly, the mistakes were not noticed. In fact, there were four main bolts holding this door together, and they were not reinstalled. And for those of you who wanted more detail, we went into this on an earlier show where we talked about the preliminary report that came out some months ago about this event, and there are extensive drawings that detail how that door looks and where the pin should be. Moving forward, on the 24th of June, 2025, about a week before we did the show on July 2nd, 2025, the NTSB had a board meeting where they went into detail about what happened on this aircraft. They shared their findings. They shared their probable cause of what happened. And John and I will go through primarily the findings to illustrate or to highlight some of the key things we think about this.
Right. So one thing I want to make clear, when the airplane, the pieces of the airplane, the fuselage, arrives in Seattle from Spirit, a good portion of the interior of the airplane is already installed. Not the seats, but the floorboards are in. In this case, the doors are in place. And a lot of the electrical is already run through the airplane, because that can be quite a chore running it through the proper locations in the fuselage after it's built. So there's a lot of pieces put in place during the assembly of the fuselage in Wichita, Kansas. And then it is shipped to Seattle, as Todd mentioned. So at this point, it's really an assembly. But part of the process of when these pieces come into the facility, and it's not just Boeing, that every aviation entity that brings in pieces from somewhere else into their facility is required to do a receiving inspection to make sure that piece conforms with whatever it is it's supposed to. And in this case, the airplane was found to have some nonconformance around the fuselage near the door. And in order to repair that area, the door had to be opened. Now, in a facility as large as Boeing, and it's staffed with assemblers, not necessarily certified airplane and power plant mechanics. All right, so these people are task trained. They're trained to do a job, and just that job, or just a few jobs. And one of the ways that the manufacturers protect themselves for some complicated areas of the airplane is they have specific crews to do that work. And in this case, this door, Boeing has a crew of people, and I've been told it was only a half a dozen people, but I don't know that to be 100% truthful. But they do have a group of people that just deal with doors. And in this particular case, this door was not handled by those individuals. So let's go down with what the NTSB has found. All right, so the first thing they do is they look at the operator. So the flight crew, the cabin crew, and the airline, in this case, Alaska Airlines, they met all the proper requirements. The second finding was there was no evidence of Alaska Airlines performing any maintenance, inspections, or rework to this airplane since delivery, which would involve opening the left exit, mid-exit door plug. This is the door in question. So the NTSB found that there was no work that was done by the airline on that door. All right, so in order to open the mid-exit door, it has to raise up out of the latches. So one of the ways that they stop that from happening on a door they're not going to use is they bolt it down in place. They put bolts in positions that the door cannot come up. It blocks the door from raising. Therefore, it can't come out of the latches. Any evidence of the door lifting before the accident flight would not have been detectable by a flight crew member performing a routine pre-flight walk-around inspection. And that includes the maintenance personnel that would also be doing visual inspections on this airplane periodically. They don't do them every day, but they do them routinely, whatever the flight hour requirement is. They talked in the report about the cabin's pressurization system, right? And there was no evidence of any previous pressurization system auto fail light illumination events that were associated with the door being displaced in flight. So there was some discussion early on about a light that came on. It was written up, but it had nothing to do with the door being displaced, they believe. Okay, it talks about the flight crew's immediate action to put their oxygen masks on because of the rapid decompression. All right, flight crews train for this routinely. Every time they go through training, it's on. It's very important that they do not delay in getting oxygen when they're at altitude, because you don't want them passing out in the worst case scenario, or even almost passing out. They get delirious because of lack of oxygen. So it's very important for the crew to don those masks immediately. All right, so the NTSB also talked about teamwork between the flight crew members, and they said that there was absolutely no issues in how the pilots and the flight attendants worked as a team to handle this problem. All right, so it talked about the procedures for switching communications back to their headsets after removing their oxygen masks. So they said this didn't contribute to anything to the safe landing of the airplane. So they didn't don their headsets. They have to take them off when you put the mask on. They didn't put them back on, but there's speakers in the cockpit so that they didn't need to. They could still hear the communications between the airplane and the air traffic control. It talks a little bit about the flight attendant's difficulty communicating And that's always been a problem when you have a hole in the airplane, which doesn't happen very often. But the wind noises are so loud that it can effectively block out any communications between the flight attendants in the cockpit. And they also talked about the ability for the flight attendants and passengers to use the overhead oxygen masks after the rapid decompression. And they indicate that that was fine. All right, so now we're moving towards the door, the findings on the door itself. The absence of the bolts on the latch, in order for the door to rise, if the bolts were there, there would have been damage to either bolts or deformation around the holes associated with the door and the guide tracks. And none was there. And that's a clear indication that the bolts were not there. The locking mechanism to keep the door from rising up out of the track was not in place. And this continues. The mid-exit door, vertical movement, arrestor bolts, upper guide track bolts, and associated hardware, it were installed before the fuselage was delivered to Boeing, but subsequently removed during the manufacturing process when the plug was opened to facilitate additional work. That gets to what I said in the beginning of this section. They needed to open the door to get in there and do some work on the fuselage. Not on the door, not on any of the associated pieces of the door, the frame and the tracks and all that, but on an area that was just adjacent to it. And A, it would facilitate doing the work, or maybe it even was mandatory. I don't know that. But in any event, they removed the door to accomplish that task. So this is a critical piece right now, and I mentioned this in the beginning. Because doors are such a complicated piece of fuselage with the latches and there's a lot of motion, like you said, it doesn't open like a regular door. It has to lift up to come out of it. So there's a lot of lot going on when you move the handle to open the door. The manufacturer, Boeing in this case, has a dedicated team to do that work. And NTSB notes that neither the door team manager nor any of the door team personnel on duty when the exit door plug was opened had any experience with opening a mid-entrance door plug. And none said they had any knowledge of who opened it, which would indicate that maybe the production people on the floor opened the door themselves in order to gain access to do the work if the door team did not open it. And that the fact that they didn't open it, and we're going to talk about it again in a minute, but I want to make it clear. The fact because the door team didn't open it, they didn't generate a card or work document in their area to go back and look at the door and close the door. So right off the bat here in the beginning, when they opened the door without the door team's knowledge, it compromises the system that's in place to keep control of things like this.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
What's the most challenging calls that you have had?
The most challenging calls that we can get here are senior pilots that are qualified, that haven't flown 25 hours or more in the last 12 months, and they don't meet our underwriting guidelines. And so those can be very challenging because you feel for them, but at the same time, you have to abide by our guideline.
And so are they always trying to, you know, finesse you and go, well, but I will, or I did, or... I mean, what do you require for them to prove that they've either flown those 25 hours or will fly those 25 hours for your underwriting?
Well, they tell us, you know, we take their word of mouth. So they tell us we're going to trust them. We're going to believe them. You know, they're going to have current flight review, valid medicals, you know, at least 25 hours. And then there's some that don't have it. They go get it. They call back.
What about the funniest phone call you've ever had where... You just started laughing because the information that you got is like there's just no way I can do anything for this person.
Well, I had a guy that called in one time, and we have basic questions that we ask. Have you had any accidents? Have you had any incidents or claims, DUIs, arrests? And when I asked that question, he said, well, yes, I used my plane to smuggle cocaine back in 1988. And I got real quiet. You could hear a pin drop. And I said, are you serious? And he said, no, I'm just messing with you. It's freaking.
So, John, to write him?
I think we quoted him, but if we were too high, I can't remember the place. That was a few years ago.
Yeah, well, carrying that caught, kind of cargo, I can imagine the premium was real high.
It caught me off guard. I was like, some people are brutally honest, and some people just like to pull your leg. So, yeah, at the end of the day, it was fun.
Can they still get insurance if they had a minor landing accident?
Yes, they certainly can. As long as it's outside 36 months, we'll take a look at everything. And
do you require them to demonstrate that they've either had recurrent training after their incident or accident? Is there any criteria? You know, because a lot of times, you know, if the FAA doesn't require a 709 ride, just a, you know, refresher or check ride, do you all require that before you'll underwrite somebody that had an incident or an accident?
We don't require it, but there's some people that do it, you know, and they'll call back and they're like, hey, I got 20 hours of dual, you know, I'm ready to go, and we'll re-underwrite it, and we'll offer coverage, because that is a great thing to say.
Great. How long have you been here, Justin?
About 5 years.
And what's the best part of your job?
The best part of the job is being able to travel, to go to air shows like Oshkosh, Sun and Fun, being able to meet our customers, you know, face-to-face, give them free things. You know, I'm always taking money from them. It's nice to be able to get them, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's
the other free little good.
Yeah, there's a good tagline. When was the last time your insurance company gave you something other than a bill?
You know, so we try to do things. But it's fun to do that.
You got a hat.
You got a hat. It's fun to go to those shows because you get to meet the customers. And when you meet them face-to-face, it's just like you've known them for a long time. And then you establish those connections over years, and they call back and, hey, I remember you.
And now, back to the Flight Safety Detectives.
Let me take this opportunity to ask a question about how things are different with a aviation maintenance technician who's certified by the FAA. If they do a repair of some kind on an aircraft, do you typically have documentation basically of every step that's being done?
Depending on where you're doing the work. Now, if it's in a heavy maintenance environment where there's an inspection document that said, that tells the people at 500 operating hours of the airplane, you will go in and check the door plug, you know, mechanism to make sure that it nothing has moved. Check the bolts to make sure they're tight. That's typically done on a check crew, and there will be paperwork for that. If that damage that we just talked about that they opened the door to accomplish, if that had happened on an in-service airplane in Barking Spider, Montana, let's just, you know, pick a location, then won't necessarily be a step-by-step instruction to do the work. Now, when you open a door, in this case, it's a door that's not very open, very much, they may refer to the manual on what to do to open the door, but there would be no specific instructions for them to do this part of a bigger project in writing, so that they would be doing it themselves. Whoever opened the door didn't generate that removal record. And that's what I was starting to say with the people at the door crew. They would generate a record of it so that as the airplane moved along, it would become known to anybody who looked at the paperwork that this task was not completed, that the door was open and it was not closed and not completed. Now, because of the way they build airplanes, the airplanes are built step by step with paperwork and procedures, all kinds of procedures. Many of them were written enhanced from when they were originally written because of problems that were not foreseen at the time they created the documents. So it's pretty robust, but you have to follow it. In number 15 of their findings, they talk about assembly removals and lacks clarity and ease of use of their system, the process instructions. They weren't a very effective generated paperwork, which is not uncommon. You know, oftentimes paperwork is written by engineers. Engineers have their own language, and when it comes down to the assembly line or the shop floor, the people that are reading it sometimes fail to understand it. Just different people, different backgrounds. In finding number 16, they talk about the on-the-job training for the assembly workers. And I mentioned this in the beginning. They're trained specifically to do a job or multiple jobs, but that's all they're trained for. And over time, they can go to different areas and learn different skills. I'm not saying that they're stuck there, but I'm saying if you're working station number 10, because the airplane moves from assembly stations down the line, the airplane's moving all the time. If you're in assembly station 10, you have certain amount of work that you have to do. If you don't get it done, you have to put a traveler on it because it'll travel with the airplane to get done further down the line. Right? But the training that individuals receive, they get hired, big company like Boeing or Airbus or all of them, there's a certain level of turnover you have from your employees. So if you're not sitting them in a classroom, which is not often done, you're training them on the job. And the NTSB found that the training, their on-the-job training, was unstructured, undocumented, and only focused on the routine building tasks, which reduces the likelihood that the door team personnel with limited exposure to non-routine tasks would be able to correct the problem. So they've identified the problem being that these individuals who are trying to accomplish their task of assembling this airplane did not have a fully documented training syllabus. It was just learn as you go, essentially. And those are my words. And sometimes just things get missed. And that's what the NTSB is saying here, that some things were missed in the process by individuals, not on purpose, but because it wasn't explained to them properly or at all in the beginning of them being assigned to this area.
And let me just add a little personal experience here. As many of you know, I was a Boeing engineer from the early 1990s to 2000, and I worked with people on the assembly line. And also we had regular updates on things that were discovered on the assembly line, things like tools left inside of fuel tanks, other equipment left inside of the aircraft, and it might be sold to the customer and discovered sometime down the line. And you think, how can you possibly leave a rag or a hammer inside of a fuel tank? Well, human nature being what it is, sometimes things get missed, and sometimes they're not discovered until many, many, many flights later.
Yes.
So what's the strangest thing you ever found manufactured inside of an aircraft and left there by accident?
I found a lot of tools. You know, maybe three or four through my career left in. I'll call it debris, a lot of stuff that wasn't tools, paperwork procedures, where they were up there working, trying to follow the procedures, and the paperwork got left in the airplane. It's not uncommon to find things. Bucking bars for rivets when we used to rivet them in place. Now that they do this work elsewhere, it's not as common. A lot of electrical problems that were not wired. The wires weren't running the way that they were supposed to. In fact, I can remember one time when we were doing the first inspection on a new airplane that had been flying for a couple of months. And we found wiring that was routed in such a way it would become hazardous to the machinery could short circuit it, rip through the installation. And that resulted in a fleet campaign directive that went out to everybody that had the airplanes to go in and look to see if they had that. And they found quite a few of them that were wrong. And, you know, it wasn't a big mistake. It was just why is it went over a piece of structure instead of behind it, and it put it at risk. So those things happen.
How about missing parts?
I don't think I've ever had any personal experience with missing parts. I've certainly heard of them, but I don't remember ever crossing an area that had any missing parts.
And this, in my opinion, the Alaska Air event was one of the most dramatic missing parts stories. In fact, the most dramatic one I've ever heard. Something that's potentially catastrophic because someone forgot a few bolts. That's not something you hear every day.
No. And I don't, you know, I put myself in the shoes of people that would be working on the airplane. Would you find that if this airplane came in for a routine inspection where you took the sidewalls inside the airplane down, and you would do that maybe only once in 10 or 12 years, unless you were refurbishing the interior of the airplane. Would I have found those bolts missing just doing a routine inspection? I don't think I would have. I don't think I would have. I think I would have looked at it. I was an inspector for a number of years. I think I would have looked at it. Everything was where it was supposed to be. These bolts were not normally on any door that I would have seen prior to this. So I think I would have missed it on the inspection. Okay, so findings 17, only door personnel, team personnel, were allowed to perform work on doors, but none were on duty at the time the door was closed. They weren't there for the opening. They didn't generate a document that would have raised that attention to them to go back and close the door, look at the door, inspect it. So because they weren't involved in the beginning, they had no reason to be back there looking at it later. And due to the absence of a removal record, these two go together, of the door, no quality to inspection would have taken place because they didn't know it was missing. They didn't know it was opened and closed. In 19, and it says a post-accident design enhancement of the door plug certified by the FAA implemented by Boeing to help ensure the complete closure of main entrance to a following opening or removal. So they put an enhanced procedure in place so that this wouldn't happen again on future assembled airplanes. In aviation, there's a trend growing around the world, and the U.S. is lagging many countries in the rest of the world, for a safety management system process. The airlines all have it today. It's proven its worth around the world. We're still on the learning curve somewhat here in the U.S. Boeing did not have, or any other manufacturers in the U.S. have, a safety management system. As part of this event, Boeing is moving in to put a safety management system process across their entire company. They're not there yet. They've got a lot of work to do to get it up. But part of what the safety management system is going to do, it's going to enhance their ability to maintain their quality standards. The NTSB also criticizes the FAA and Boeing that their corrective actions in the beginning were ineffective for this because they've had other assembly problems. And let's not forget that during this process, both Boeing and Airbus were really pushing very hard to increase the number of airplanes they put out every month because the demand by the airlines around the world was so high. So they were pushing pretty hard to increase the production of the airplanes, speeding up the process, which also lends itself to people making mistakes. One of the next recommendations is the paperwork. And I'm not going to go through all of this. Nobody signs. Everybody has a stamp, a unique stamp that's identifies them. And you stamp off on the paperwork. And there was a lot of processes that were used routinely and they lump them all into what they call a shot stamp process. But in any event, it wasn't what it was supposed to be, and it was used to expedite what they were doing, and they were called out for it. And the FAA was called out for allowing that to happen. There were previous problems that were identified, but yet the system wasn't corrected. So the FAA people on site knew about it, and Boeing's management knew about it, and it was allowed to continue.
Now, in all fairness to those involved in the manufacturing process, you say to yourself, how can this possibly happen? How could it possibly happen? This is a complex process. This is a process that goes on often 24 hours a day, and it's literally possible to work on a project for years and not meet the person who was working in that same section a different shift, not meet a person who was involved with the design of it or whatever. You show up, you do your job, and you say to yourself, I don't know how this entire process works. I said that all the time when I was at Boeing. And very few people have such a comprehensive knowledge of everything that goes on the factory floor and beyond that they know exactly what they're looking at, exactly what they're dealing with at all points in time, which is why it's a team effort. No one person can do it.
So the next several recommendations deal with Boeing and the SMS system. You know, says they didn't have one, but they're starting to develop one and implementing it. And the role of the FAA. The FAA wasn't very proactive. They are a reactive agency by design, but in manufacturing, they should be more proactive than reactive. Talks about Boeing safety culture, which is too much detail for us to go in here. They go back to the oxygen masks. So they recommend that they do better scenario-based exercises. They reach in and talk about the circumstances of this accident, and others highlight the need for hands-on aircraft-specific crew training and procedures for the oxygen system. So this was aimed at Alaska Airlines and the FAA. And the portable oxygen bottles that the flight attendants use, they had difficulties using them with the masks. So it talks about changing those procedures to make it easier. So they also had a problem with Alaska Airlines. After the flight landed, power was kept on the airplane. The voice recorder overwrote a lot of the data. So they didn't have the benefit of having the most accurate data. And I, at this point, I want to just raise an issue, state an issue that we didn't state in earlier. On the India accident, the 787, their recorder, voice recorder, holds 200 hours of recording, not 25. So they, and that's been an NTSB recommendation for a long time. So while I was there, we recommended almost every accident to get more time. So, and it's not so much for that specific event, accident or whatever event, but it allows us to go back and see how the flight crews behaved previous. And we had one business aircraft accident happened here in Massachusetts, at Hanscom. And we went back and found out that the flight crew in that case, out of 170-something takeoffs, failed to do the checklist and 150 of them. I forget the numbers. But because we had robust recorders, we could go back and clearly see that this particular captain on this airplane wasn't doing what he should have been doing.
Quick clarification, number 33 on the findings. Circumstances of this accident and others show that cockpit voice recorders, CVR, with a 25-hour recording capability are necessary, yada, yada, yada. In fact, I think this was a 2-hour recorder on this aircraft. And you said 25, but I think it was 2, and 25 would be good. 200, like on the advanced recorder you talked about with the 787, would be even better. Because there you can go by and go, like you said, with the accident in Hanscom. Go through several different flights and see if not just the accident crew, but other crews had the same propensity to perform checklists inadequately, etc. So more is better. And as all of you know, who are on computers for a while, every couple of years, the cost of storage drops by a factor of two, roughly. So there's no reason why you can't have a 25-hour, 200-hour recorder in a modern cockpit voice recorder.
Yeah, it doesn't take much, and the chips are smaller and smaller. This one is near and dear to my heart. Number 34, child restraints. All right, so they had an issue on the airplane with a child. Fortunately, nothing bad happened, but they did have a lap child on the airplane in the general area of when this door blew out. Fortunately, the parent was able to hold on to the child. And if you've ever sat next to me with an unrestrained child, we have a discussion. Because it's really, really criminal that the FAA doesn't require every person to have a seat. And the example that I use all the time when I'm talking to the parents and whoever I can get their ear is that flight attendants can and have been suspended, fined for failing to secure a coffee pot in the galley. But we allow children up to 2 years old to be unsecured in the cabin. Clear air turbulence being what it is, just one of the risks. I mean, they can become a UFO inside the cabin, hurt themselves and others because they're flying around in a very turbulent situation. So it is really, really criminal that we don't require our children to be secured.
And it's also, I wouldn't say criminal, but I think it is not good parenting to say to yourself, you know what, they say children are two. My 2.5-year-old looks like they're two. Let me save a couple $100. Life of your child versus a couple $100. Yeah, it's tempting, but fight that temptation. Have a seat for the child. Have a proper child restraint system for that child. And you'll sleep better on the plane. And so will your child.
For my grandkids, I went out and bought a very expensive, specifically designed aviation seat for the kids. Specifically designed for aviation. It was very expensive. But I, after doing accidents for as many years as I have, I knew that I didn't want my grandkids flying unsecured. So, and my kids bought the tickets. I would have bought the ticket if they didn't, because I feel that strongly about it. So the lap children, they talk about the lap children. And that was all the findings that they had. And I don't think we'll go through the recommendations on this show because it's already going quite long. But you can see how thorough the NTSB went through there. Not only the accident involved Alaska Airlines, they not only went and looked at Alaska Airlines, their procedures, the maintenance inspections, all everything that they normally would do in an accident for Alaska Airlines. But then they went back and did an in-depth view at the manufacturer level to look at how the manufacturer made a mistake here and what the consequences of that mistake and what the manufacturer had to do to mitigate what was found. So it's clear the NTSB did a very good job on this particular event. And on a later show, we'll talk about the probable cause and the safety recommendations.
Now, the one small postscript about this actual aircraft that was involved in this event. It was a fairly new aircraft. But about 3 months after the event, Boeing repurchased the aircraft from Alaska Airlines. And it's now sitting in a boneyard, not flying anywhere. I'm not sure if it's because there was something inherently structurally wrong with the aircraft or if there were for other reasons that Boeing wanted to take this airplane off the market, but there is a 0% chance you'll be flying on this aircraft anytime soon.
Well, there are a number of lawsuits pending, and that may be the reason why they pulled it off. Many people, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners don't know this, but after every plane crash, all the bits and pieces, after the NTSB does their thing, all the bits and pieces are collected and they're put into storage. And some of them are in storage for a very long time. If I remember right, and this is memory, so it might not be 100% accurate, but I remember right, the Sioux City, Iowa accident involving the DC-10 that had the engine go boom and lost the hydraulics that controlled the airplane, that airplane was still in storage 20 years later because the lawsuits were still pending. And TWA 800 was stored out in at an NTSB facility out on in Virginia, and they started to take that apart to dispose of it when they had to stop because of a pending lawsuit. And they did whatever testing they had to do, and then they finished disposing of the bits and pieces of the airplane. So they don't go away for a long time. All right, Todd, we've been talking a lot on this one.
We have indeed, because this is a very detailed report, and it's all about details, and this is basically my second to last word. Aviation is about details. When you're operating an aircraft, when you're maintaining an aircraft, when you're producing an aircraft, even the design of the aircraft, there are regulations that one has to follow. And personally, when I was a safety engineer, we spent a lot of our time dealing with adhering to the regulations, understanding the requirements, not just the Boeing requirements, but also the FAA requirements, so that this aircraft could go out there into the world and, you know, not cause a problem. So is this a little tedious? For some, yes, but it's a necessary part of aviation.
Yes, and you're going to post a lot of the documents that we have on the video portion of this, correct?
Very much so. There's also some ancillary material from the NTSB from various briefings that some of you might find interesting. So there will be no shortage of things to chew on with this one.
Okay, so now I'm moving to my last word. I talk about pre-planning for your flight. You know, do it twice. Do it at home before you go to the airport, and do it again at the airport to make sure they agree. And then go when you go out to the airplane to do a good pre-flight. And, you know, and when you do these shows, sometimes it's very rewarding what you hear come back. And I don't know if I said this on the last show or not, but we got an email from a young student pilot who was at the airport to go fly with an instructor. That instructor was out flying with a student just prior to his turn, if you will, and the airplane landed. The instructor and the previous student went inside to do a debrief, and this young man went out to do the walk around on his airplane. And lo and behold, one of the things I say is look for a missing cotter pin. He looked and found a cotter pin missing on a clevis that was half backed out. So he went inside and got the instructor and the student and brought them out. And I forget how he said it, but he said one of them was actually turned white when they realized how close they came to having a major problem. So please, please do a good pre-flight. Now, I'm going to add a little piece here. In a couple of weeks, Oshkosh is in Wisconsin, the week of the 21st of July. Todd and I are going to be out there. We're going to have our video recorders with us, and we're going to walk around some airplanes and just point out some things that you can do as a student pilot, as a real pilot, a certified pilot, or anybody with an interest to look at the airplane and help maintain its airworthiness. Pilots responsible for the airworthiness of the airplane. So we're going to help the pilots a little bit. As I often tell pilots in this last segment, if you don't know how to do a good pre-flight, get a mechanic that works on that airplane and have them walk you through a good pre-flight. We're all in this game together. We should be helping one another up and down. You don't want to, I want to eliminate the the dumb accidents, the dumb problems, because we missed something we shouldn't have missed. Or we did something we shouldn't do. Because I see too many of those. And the accident rate would come down considerably if we would change what we do. And I've been tracking events at airports that don't necessarily raise to an NTSB investigation. I have amassed quite a number of them. I haven't categorized them yet. That's coming in a future show. But I'll tell you, some of them are absolutely, I just don't know how people can be that dumb. But we'll talk about that at a later date. So do a good pre-flight, very thorough. When you get in the air, put the head on a swivel, because we still have so many student pilots out there. And being young and learning, they're going to make mistakes. Just today at lunchtime, the waiter at my table for lunch today saw my phone with a six-pack on the back. You can't see it. Oh, there you go. All right. It's one of those phone cases that has the six-pack on it. He saw that my phone was sitting on the table, ended up with a 15-minute conversation. He's got 150 hours. He wants to be a commercial pilot. We had a long discussion. So please put your head on a swivel when you're flying. Don't become a media issue. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Without the right insurance, you're Sierra Oscar Lima. Vemco Insurance Company is the only direct writer in the market and never uses third-party agents or brokers. Instead, they connect you directly with real underwriters with real answers in their Frederick, Maryland office, ready to solve problems and approve coverage based on your flying. Floats to wheels and back to floats. Avemco gives you more flexibility. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety today. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for 5% off your premium.